491.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California. New York Island. Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 321, recorded on August 21st, 2020. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey, recording in Newton, Massachusetts. Joining me in Massachusetts, as often he is my co-host, Nate. Hello, Nate.
Great to be here, Bill.
And we also have a guest this week. Lily Geismer is the author of Don't Blame Us, Suburban Liberalism and the Transformation of the Democratic Party. The book, published in 2015, traces the reorientation of modern liberalism and the Democratic Party away from the roots in the labor halls of northern cities and toward white-collar suburbanites in the post-industrial metropolitan periphery, specifically the Route 128 corridor where Nate and I grew up. And she is an associate professor of history at Claremont McKenna College. So, Dr. Geismer, welcome to the program.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me, and I'm excited to be with two fellow Massachusetts natives.
Yeah, so I guess the first question is the sort of obvious one. How did you hone in on this particular both geographical region and this Don't Blame Us theme as the subject to explore sort of the wider shift in the Democratic Party from, you know, the 1970s to the 90s and present day?
Sure. So the book's origins, it started out as my dissertation, and I began it in 2004, 2005, in the aftermath of the 2004 election, which had John Kerry as one of the candidates. And one of the things that after he lost, there was a sense of kind of Massachusetts liberalism itself and the Democratic Party and Massachusetts liberalism in particular as being kind of dead or over. And that didn't really sync with two things that that I had seen growing up. One is that there's a very kind of vibrant sort of liberalism or sense of and Democratic Party in Massachusetts. So it didn't seem like it was dead. But the other part of it is the sort of descriptions of it as being overwhelmingly liberal and progressive didn't really align with what I knew of Massachusetts, and particularly the contradictions of it being in many ways liberal or voting very Democratic, but also being profoundly racially segregated and economically unequal. And so I wanted to kind of understand that contradiction and to think about how Massachusetts, which is often seen as kind of exceptional in American politics, was actually representative of this bigger shift, and especially because of the kind of large number of knowledge workers who reside in its kind of suburban ring. So that was the kind of origins of the book's idea.
Yeah, so a lot of the book talks about sort of the George McGovern campaign and how that led to a sense of Massachusetts exceptionalism as well, although maybe it shouldn't have. And similarly, again, with the 1988 election with Mike Dukakis's defeat, same effect as what you were talking about with 2004, this kind of sense of isolation of Massachusetts. But then the point that you're arguing in the book is, at least in part, is that in fact, the Democratic Party did basically adopt a bunch of things from McGovern and from Dukakis, and they were not the things that either of those candidates were being portrayed as being by the Republican opponents, you know, as these sort of far left candidates who were going to take us back in time to whether it was the 60s or even the New Deal and things like that. And in fact, kind of moving us in this other direction toward these like, you know, focus on the knowledge workers as the base, focus on the suburbs as the new base, which seems to have definitely consolidated recently, as we'll get into. And then, of course, also the public-private partnerships and trying to solve problems that way. I found it interesting, you know, as I said, Nate and I grew up in the 128 corridor, and you have that background as well. But the point that you argue in the book is essentially that those professional knowledge economy workers in the suburbs, in the tech industry, were not exceptional as maybe people thought with those "Don't Blame Us" bumper stickers after McGovern won only Massachusetts and D.C., but rather they're emblematic of these trends happening in other places in the country as well, though you don't talk too much about those in this particular book. Silicon Valley, the Research Triangle, these are also important bases for the current Democratic Party, and we sort of see where this is headed with what happened in Massachusetts. And similarly, although I don't think you talked about it in the book, I think there's been a lot of focus lately on the suburbs around D.C. and Northern Virginia and like the defense industry stuff there. And that is, of course, similar to like Raytheon being based in the 128 corridor. Is that sort of a fair assessment of kind of some of the comparative points to this region?
Yeah, so that you can see. And I think a lot of people who have read the book who didn't grow up in Massachusetts or have a kind of close connection can understand the kind of constellation of politics within other kinds of affluent post-industrial suburban areas. And so what I was trying to do is kind of go deep into one particular place to kind of show that it wasn't necessarily exceptional, but representative of these other kinds of places. And I think that the ones that you pointed out are very in the kind of the Bay Area, and then also in Northern Virginia. And a lot of these are places that have ties to both kind of originally the military-industrial complex, and then into the kind of high-tech areas. And so I was understanding those kinds of workers and their politics for thinking about the larger sort of shift in the Democratic Party. And I think also one of the other things is that the party has really understood how crucial, I mean, that really is the base, but how crucial those kinds of voters are to winning. So there's a sense of kind of suburban voters really hold a tremendous amount of sort of political capital and power.
Well, in 2018, we got that kind of bizarre, evocative phrase of Panera Bread Democrats, this idea of this very specific type of suburban Democrats. But something else that kind of emerges in the course of this book is that the focus on this suburban base, which, you know, in some ways, as we can talk about, there were obviously suburbs that were very Republican. This is talking about kind of a counterpoint where we're going in the other direction with suburbs moving in a more Democratic direction. And that certainly seems to be a centerpiece of the 2016 and now 2020 general election strategies, at least apparently. But that this strategy of focusing on these suburban knowledge workers in many ways cut off the Democratic Party from other existing or potential bases of support, particularly among, at the time, urban minorities. Now there's been a little bit of a switch with some of the urban and suburban populations starting to reverse places, but similar like class dimension there.
Yeah, and so that's one of the questions is sort of what are the trade-offs of having affluent suburban voters be the kind of centerpiece of your base? I mean, both in terms of who kind of Democratic candidates appeal to, but also, I mean, a lot of the book and my interests have to do with the kind of policy dimensions and what kinds of policy priorities suburban liberals advocate for and sort of want to see their politicians and their I guess their state and federal governments represent, and local governments actually to a large degree. Yeah. So that was the other sort of question of kind of what become the kind of the trade-offs in that shift.
There was one particular paragraph near the beginning of the book that really struck me as someone who is an elected official now in Newton, and someone who has run previously in the most of the 128 corridor, including all of the case study communities. Suburban activists along Route 128 proved equally effective at navigating the political culture of their own communities, adopting a strategy that couched issues to align with and complement the privileges and priorities of suburban residency. Such strategies enabled activists to earn support for potentially controversial issues such as voluntary integration or opposition to the Vietnam War among more moderate neighbors, and channel that support through the political process. This pragmatic approach, however, often foreclosed the possibility of subsequent reform and restricted the possibility of more comprehensive change. These tactics also made it difficult for suburban liberals to create coalitions across racial, economic, and spatial lines. I mean, that is the most familiar paragraph in the world to me, because I am a leftist politically, and I say that to distinguish from the liberalism that we're talking about. I am the believer in public ownership and worker ownership of things, and this brings me inherently into conflict quite a lot with the liberal traditions, especially the neoliberal traditions where you use the market to solve your various social and economic problems, and this constant sort of negotiating of, like, how do I put this into terms, into the, like, marketized personal choice terms that is going to get these people who agree with the endpoints to come around to my way of thinking of how we get there, and also dealing with these people when they're in their activist groups or whatever, just like not considering at all how somebody else might think about the same problem, including, you know, like Black and Latino people in Boston or whatever, which sometimes in many cases, as you talk about in the book, in the cases in like the 1970s with issues around housing and busing and things like that, a lot of times they believed that they were the things they were undertaking were to help those people, but they weren't really consulting them either. Those people were not generally part of those coalitions, with few exceptions.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it is the kind of the continuation of that particular set. I mean, I think that that's one of the things that I came to is not. I mean, there's, all joking aside, of the many ways in the book the word blame works, but not blaming some of the more, I guess, left leaning activists for some of this, the sort of the kind of decisions that they made, but trying to understand them and understand the kind of sort of landscape in which they were operating, which was really challenging. I think initially I was like, how could they not have, like, you know, gone full scale into kind of challenging structural inequity? And you realize the kind of the tight landscape in which you operate, that, you know, and I think this is one thing that's been really interesting in the kind of contemporary discussion about where suburban liberals are. You know, there's this idea that all of a sudden they become really progressive, but I think when you actually, like, sort of pierce at it, what does that progressivism look like? And that was one thing I saw similarly to in the 60s, because one of the reasons, I mean, one of the other kind of arguments, and I think this is more sort of historically based, is that the suburbs were, like, sort of monolithically conservative. And the thing that I found in my book, and why I wanted to focus on places like Newton and Lexington, and I, you know, people always ask me why I picked those suburbs, and I think this is a thing of sort of being from Boston. It was both from being, it was both that they were kind of on the Route 128 corridor, so they had this connection to the tech industry, but also because I knew that those were places that had this sort of tradition of being quite liberal. Mm-hmm. And also really caring about education and their kids' education. So that's another thing that's, I think, is really important. But I think that it was a question of kind of what, that there were people who were working towards trying to sort of address civil rights or environmentalism in the Vietnam War. But kind of what did that sort of, what were the outcomes of that kind of political activism?
Right. Well, there's a tension that is running through all of this with these 128 communities that I think is the similar thing to what we're seeing in terms of, let's say, Romney 2012 voters who then become Hillary Clinton 2016 voters, and potentially Joe Biden voters in this year remains to be seen, of, you know, this sort of, it's a balancing act of the social liberalism versus the fiscal conservatism. In some suburbs, in some regions of the country, we're always more focused on the fiscal conservatism and low taxes, and some were more focused on the social liberalism. But that's not to say that in both places it may have been, they may have had both of those there in competition, and it was a question of which one was being weighed more. So before I go to Nate, just to sort of, again, re-summarize kind of the trend line of what we're talking about here, in the specific Massachusetts suburbs that you focused on in the book were Newton, Brookline, Lexington, Concord, and Lincoln, although, of course, there's a lot of references as well to Wellesley, which is next to Newton, more as like a well, it's another sort of symbolic suburb that people, you know, that had a reputation of a kind that people would seize on, but a slightly different one. And that has now been, I would argue, as we'll get to later, been sort of more firmly integrated into the rest of the set. But Newton in particular is an example, I think, of the overall trends that you analyzed with the takeover of the local Democratic Party by the anti-Vietnam activists against the traditional machine Dems. That's something they still talk about here. The rise of Congressman Father Drynan, the liberal priest, initially in the 3rd District, which spanned some of the key areas of that professional 128 region, but then also went out past the industrial areas of Fitchburg, where he didn't really do very well. The fall of the dominant local Republican Party in the old liberal Massachusetts Republican tradition, that was a huge change that happened, and that was in favor of this new sort of suburban-oriented Democratic Party in Massachusetts. For sort of comparison, this current term in 2020 on the city council in Newton, there are no Republicans. The mayor is a former Republican, but back when Nate and I were in elementary school, Teddy Mann, who was mentioned in the book, he was the mayor, one of the longest serving officials in city history. And I know that at least the 4 previous mayors before him in the post-war period were all Republicans. I don't even know before that. My dad was joking that they may have been Republican mayors since the beginning of time. But a lot of the thing that I found interesting, too, is while you can go talk to people who were part of that sort of like anti-war peace movement takeover of the local Democratic Party in Newton, and up until even a few years ago, a lot of them were still in charge of stuff here or elected officials here, I would argue that they're now fairly conservative within the party. They will talk about, you know, how they cut their teeth in the civil rights movement or the anti-war movement or the single issue advocacy for abortion rights, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're on the cutting edge of the party at this point. But in many cases, that's not necessarily a contradiction because, as you've argued in the book, this is the faction that took over the establishment of the party. So, of course, they became party establishment people. And it's not necessarily a contradiction in terms of what the full scope of the platform was. These communities had this sort of surge of the liberal activism in the 1970s that offered these individualist-oriented and middle-class-oriented solutions to problems. And then at the end of the 1970s, there were these bitter fights and divides over capping property taxes because the taxes were supposedly too high. And this culminated with the state referendum in 1980, Proposition 2.5, that still is a severe restriction even to today, as I obviously have to deal with now as a city councilor. And this inspired other states to follow suit, although California had already done that. Even as this was happening, you had the same tension happening in like the presidential elections between like Carter and Reagan. And, you know, Newton, I guess, did vote no on Prop 2.5 and voted for Carter over Reagan. But there were other places in the state where those didn't necessarily line up. And you had people voting both for Reagan and against the tax cap or for the tax cap and, you know, against Reagan, things like that. Nate, I know you wanted to talk about the issue of the feminist movement and how the suburban dimensions of that not only shaped the feminist movement, but also like cut off parts of the rest of the feminist movement from other things that were happening, you know, in other places in Massachusetts.
Yeah. I mean, first, I guess I just wanted to mention some of the resonance of the various struggles over the growth and transport issues. You talked about the inner belt protests and how that was eventually taken up by Governor Sargent, and eventually the protest eventually blocked the Inner Belt. And there's a big mural of the protests stopping a bulldozer on the Micro Center here in Cambridge. So I would say that's something that still has resonance. And so about the feminism aspects, I know that just because my grandmother was involved with NARAL as a board member and as a president briefly at one point in the late 70s. And so I was just sort of interested in that sort of ramp up first with the Equal Rights Amendment in 1976, that effort, and then the sort of late 70s opposition to the Doyle-Flynn abortion restriction bill and sort of how that tied into the sort of choice rhetoric that has, you know, stuck with the sort of pro-abortion rights movement continuing to this day.
Yeah, I mean, so there's this vibrant kind of suburban feminism. And one of the things that I think comes out in the long trajectory of the book is the kind of role of women as kind of key drivers of liberal politics. It goes back to like the very first thing I ever looked at, interested in this project, was looking at a protest that happened around fair housing in Lexington, and it said that it was civil rights activists when I read it in the newspaper. And then I saw a picture of the protest, and it was all white suburban women. With their children. I think that they presumably, I guess you can still call them civil rights activists, but it wasn't the kind of, that was really who in these suburban communities who was driving the politics. And a lot of that by the 70s got translated into feminist politics. I think another thing that happened is that's also what happened to the kind of downward trajectory of other kinds of political activism around things like the peace movement or other kinds of things got channeled into feminism. Another thing is a lot of women went back to work actually in the 70s. And so that had an effect on kind of local activism in various different ways. But I think that the kind of feminism that you see does sort of fall in line with thinking about the kind of interests of white middle class women, and is a place where you really see. So I talk a lot about these ideas of like sort of choice feminism, which kind of is market based in its own way. It's a market. It's a kind of market idea. But lose a kind of a connection to kind of thinking about forms of structural inequity, and I think that has had a real effect on the kind of evolution of feminism more broadly, and kind of the types of coalition building that you see. So you see these victories. I mean, there are these ways in which the kind of fighting for the ERA and then also around fighting against kind of really restrictive abortion politics. But that also sort of has a limiting factor on what kind of the possibilities of feminism in this particular moment. Mm-hmm. So it's not to undermine your grandmother's contributions.
I just thought it was interesting.
There's a way of thinking about kind of this idea that the broader what feminism, the sort of endpoint of feminism should be sort of a sense of choice and not kind of a different type of kind of meaningful equity.
Well, one of the things that we talk about on this show fairly frequently, our female co-hosts are not on today because this is not their specialty. They're not from the 128 corridor, but we talk about this notion of, is the objective of feminism to elect female presidents and appoint female CEOs, or is it to like liberate everyone and not just women, but just like make ordinary people's lives better and more egalitarian and so forth? And one of the things that I felt like comes out in the chapter on the women's struggle is that the focus on choice dovetails neatly into that sort of elite C-suite and presidentialist orientation, but it doesn't work very well with, you know, the feminist issues facing, say, the Black and Latino community in the 70s in Boston.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in that some of the, and it's a really interesting question because actually, Nate, you mentioned earlier the question around the Inner Belt, which was this effort to kind of create that there was going to be an extra highway. And this actually, for people who are not from Massachusetts, throughout the country, there are these huge protests against highway construction. So there was a sense of kind of by the 60s that like a recognition that the construction of highways had really decimated urban communities. And so fighting against kind of the building of another one of these. And the interesting thing about highways, or in LA we call them freeways, is that they actually do like link communities in all kinds of ways. And so one of the powerful things about the Inner Belt fight was that you actually see various different communities coming together. One of the things is that their interests are quite different. And so that you can kind of often have these kinds of coalitions that occur over on short-term issues. So fighting against the Inner Belt. But then when it actually got turned into kind of creating a kind of more equitable transportation system in Massachusetts, those kinds of coalitions break down. And I think similarly on feminism, that there's often these kinds of moment flashpoints where there is some sort of cross race, cross class coalition building that can happen, but it's just not really sustained. And I think, I mean, some of that to me is something that's structured into the built environment, and like the work environment of many people. So that if you live in a suburban community, even one like Newton, which is relatively, you know, has close proximity to Boston, most people aren't sort of interacting at it with different people of different kinds of races and classes or experiences in their daily life. They don't, and often don't work with them either. So that really sort of separates who you sort of understand or see, and kind of, I think, really prevents kind of that kind of understanding and coalition building. So there's something sort of, there is something in the suburban or I would say sort of metropolitan landscape that prevents that from happening.
So a lot of this choice rhetoric that was firmly adopted by the pro-choice, to use the phrase, movement, the abortion rights movement. Now, I mean, I would argue that you frequently get national organizations being like very insistent in disciplining, like rhetorically, that this is the rhetoric that we are continuing to use, and if you use anything else, that it's not good. Which then you see some of the younger feminists like rejecting some of that and saying, like, no, it's not, we're not pro-choice, we're pro-abortion, that it's okay to say that. And there's, you know, but a lot of that rhetoric comes out of this Massachusetts push. But as you argue in the book, it fits into this huge pantheon of approaching a whole range of issues, cultural issues, social issues, economic issues, where everything is oriented around these suburban professionals and their notions and understandings of choice and freedom. Some people, especially if they're in a lower class position with less sort of material power and connections and things like that, might view freedom differently, in the sense of like, I want to be, you know, healthcare would make, like, free healthcare from the government would make me freer and give me more choices. That is not the view of choice that was prevalent or is prevalent in the professional class suburbs in this 128 corridor with all these high tech workers, defense industry workers, and so forth. That, I think, you know, I mean, it ultimately culminates, as I'll bring up in a second, with the economic side of this, the employment training choices program that we get under Mike Dukakis. But it goes back farther than that, because it goes back to sort of the McGovern campaign approach. It goes back to the lack of union density and some of the hostility toward unions, even as the economic conditions deteriorate in the 70s after the McGovern campaign. One of the things that I didn't realize, which I think, again, goes to that issue of like Massachusetts sort of self-isolating after these election defeats saying that it's exceptional in some way and doubling down on that. One of the reasons that Nixon didn't win Massachusetts in 1972, and in fact didn't win it by 9 points, so it wasn't really that close, was because his policy of winding down the Vietnam War defense contracts very specifically hurt the Route 128 corridor in Massachusetts, and he didn't have a plan to give those people jobs doing something else. But George McGovern and the new Congressman Robert Drinan were explicitly talking about joblessness by name in the Route 128 corridor. But again, that, you know, there's this very clear pivot over this period away from like, we're going to bring back the jobs, which even McGovern wasn't really saying. He was pitching like, we're going to do something else, essentially. But it's, there's this, you know, you could have had a moment where people losing their jobs, first because of the budget cuts and then because of the stagflation period and everything, that could have led to, you know, a wave of unionization or something, and we could have turned the tide on unions. And instead, everything went in the complete opposite direction. I mean, the thing I always talk about is that there's a tension now over what does the word progressive mean, because so many Democrats call themselves progressive regardless of, you know, where they are on a lot of different issues. But a lot of that actually isn't, you know, just obfuscation. It dates back to the fact that you had a group of people who genuinely believed that, you know, unions were the old thing, and in order to progress, you had to progress away from unions. And this notion, you refer to it, or quote people who referred to it as middle-class Emersonian individualists. It could be argued that they had more in common with the Reagan right, but they happened to vote for the Democratic candidate. And in some cases, it was because of specific things like this, where McGovern was pitching a solution for the 128 corridor very specifically. The non-union engineers not only didn't end up joining unions in large numbers as this was happening. But in fact, they were you had the ones who kept their jobs criticized unemployed engineers as whiners for expressing support for unions and pushed toward getting the latter into these sort of self-help support groups and skills retraining programs rather than unions, which I feel like is almost now a bedrock of like just 30, 40 years, or 50 years almost at this point of Democratic Party rhetoric, where it's this very vague hand wave towards skills retraining as opposed to unions.
Yeah, and so I think there's a lot going on there. And I think one of the things, and this goes to connecting to the feminist question, has to do with this kind of that oftentimes the way that people think about kind of class politics is this kind of separation of material and cultural values. And so one thing that I really want to show through suburban residents was the ways that those things actually become conflated. And so people have actually like their material and cultural values are sort of deeply, deeply intertwined. And they think about things in various different ways. And so I think the feminist question is also this kind of deep sense of individualism, which kind of feminism offered, and that has a double-edged sword to it. But I think you also see that is a kind of firm component of liberal post-war liberal politics, is this kind of faith in individualism. And also the other key word there is meritocracy. And that's kind of this driving idea of and the kind of faith in kind of technical solutions to problems that will sort of solve things. And that actually goes back to the kind of the big P progressives too. This kind of idea that you sort of have you kind of apply particular kinds of technical solutions. And I think that is antithetical to a lot of the ways that people traditionally think about what unions do. I think there are a couple of things there that happen. I mean, is this kind of lack of thinking sort of collectively, and that if you are part of a union, it'll take that away. You'll take away your individualism. It also there's a notion I think amongst many kind of post-industrial workers that unions are anti-meritocratic. So if that's kind of a driving idea, and I think especially if you're kind of an engineer, that leads to that particular kind of thinking. So there's this kind of hostility towards unions. And I think it's right, like it could have gone in that way, that there was this moment in the early 70s that was like, maybe they will have this kind of mass white collar unionization. And it didn't happen. And it's interesting right now, there's kind of a new kind of resurgence of white collar unionization happening. So that there's a parallel there. So that's one piece of what you were talking about. I'm trying to think of the other things that you said that I wanted to gesture to. But I think I think there has been, and what the thing that I was mapping, and I'm actually looking at more in my next book project, but is the Democratic Party's kind of turn away from union voters or union politics as kind of a drag on the party, and that both in terms of kind of vote, like sort of as voters, but also in terms of kind of the solution to problems of economic growth in the 1970s, as you go through this period of deindustrialization, Keynesian economics isn't working. They're looking for other kinds of models, which goes to a more kind of post-industrial global model, and that unions seem to be sort of in tension with that. And so I think that kind of another thing that you start to see, and you can see it in the politics of someone like Mike Dukakis, that did not run, never had the kind of support, strong support amongst union voters, nor do a lot of the kind of Democratic, the people who sort of rise to presidential politics in the late after Mondale, that's not kind of part of their kind of agenda. That was a lot of different, various different things, but.
Specifically on Dukakis, I was sort of interested in the two matchups between Edward King and Dukakis, where King knocks off Dukakis after his first term, and then Dukakis comes back and wins. But, you know, sort of King as a figure I thought was interesting, almost like presage a sort of Trumpian politics in some ways, sort of just like resonating with like a white ethnic urban groups, and even down to where you had the Cambridge mayor Ackerman sort of running as the progressive third party candidate in the race, and split some votes away from people that thought Dukakis was being a little bit too moderate. And sort of the cultural politics at play, you mentioned the sort of Chablis and Brie versus the Joe Sixpack sort of cultural comparison between the types of voters there. And that's something like the wine track and the beer track Democratic voter has like stuck with us for a long time ever since then. So I just thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah, and I think this goes to actually something that Bill brought up earlier about the kind of long tradition of liberal Republicans in places like Newton and these kind of bifurcated voting patterns. And so that you have a strong tradition of kind of moderate Republicans and the kind of what and against kind of that. So at the state level in Massachusetts, like many of the most conservative people were Democrats. And so, I mean, in some ways, Mike Dukakis is trying to kind of, that was one of the things that he was trying to kind of cut against when he ran. And I think a lot of this kind of new generation of Democrats were trying to rise above the kind of old tradition. But I think that's right. Like Ed King stands in for these kind of, this older tradition. I think a lot of them, I mean, they become what's known as initially as Reagan Democrats who vote strongly for Reagan and I think contributed in some ways to Massachusetts winning. I mean, Reagan very, very narrowly won Massachusetts in 1980, but that trend carries on. And I do think you see it you can trace it to some of the kinds of Trump-esque supporters or kind of or particular kinds of politics and where I think that there's still that kind of tradition alive in Massachusetts and in a lot of other places too.
Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, on the other side, you have the rise of the Atari Dems that we've talked about. And I feel like the phrase Atari Dems like has now become larger and more culturally resonant. I think it was in the Front Runner, the Gary Hart movie that came out a couple of years ago. They mentioned the Atari Dems. So I just feel
I didn't realize that. I still haven't seen that movie. I have to watch it.
Yeah.
But it's such a great, it's like one of my favorite expressions. So.
Yeah, exactly. So I feel like that phrase is now like more people are hearing it and like trying to understand what it means. So,
and yeah, you also, I mean, and I think ahead. It stands in for sort of this, I mean, I think it's both this kind of particular moment, but thinking about the Democratic Party's close relationship to the tech industry and where that kind of emerges from.
And it definitely the tech industry connection, I feel like if you're not from Massachusetts, and even if you are, some people don't realize the extent to which the tech sector is such a huge force here. I mean, now it's more of the biotech specifically. But at the time, it could have had a Silicon Valley type of thing going on here. I mean, and that was, I think a lot of people thought that was what was going to happen. One of the things that I also wanted to emphasize, drawing on what Nate just said and what you just said, I feel like the tradition that Dukakis inherits, although he manages to, kind of make peace with the labor leadership, I guess, the tradition that he inherits for the most part and is back to what I said about this takeover of the Democratic Party between the 1968 election and the 1972 election, where you have this liberal insurgency that overthrows a lot of the existing party bosses. They turf out the existing congressmen in the case with the electing Drynan instead. But this rejection of union bosses becomes inextricably tied in with the rejection of these, as you say, conservative Democratic urban machine bosses and the machine Democrats who controlled stuff out in the suburbs, despite their, just because of that was how the party worked before then. But I think those things can't be separated. Again, we could have had this moment where we went in this unionization direction, but that would have, in order for that to happen, they would have had to pursue what we're now seeing, as you alluded to, which is a rank and file strategy where you also are reforming the unions. Because, I mean, there's no disputing that the unions in many cases were very problematic and in some cases mobbed up. And just like generally, it was not a good situation, even for the cause of unionization, what was going on. But the approach would, into my mind, is you fix the union as opposed to just rejecting unions completely. But that was not the direction they went in. And I think that what you see, like the sort of clear example of how that manifests, not even on just the economic dimension as a whole, but like very specifically, is the anti-war push in the suburbs. You have guys literally working for Raytheon and being like, I'm an anti-war or at least anti-Vietnam War liberal Democrat. And the point that you argue in the book is that there's this liberal technocratic approach of I'm going to work within the system to change things. I'm going to, in this case, we see this today too of Raytheon or Lockheed or whatever sponsoring like girls empowerment in the Marvel universe or whatever. Just these kind of absurd things where like that's how you're going to change the, within the system, or you're going to be an LGBTQ CIA officer or whatever. But a lot of that goes back to these anti-war defense tech guys. If we're looking at other countries, what was happening is you would have dock workers and factory workers refusing to load ships with stuff that was going to the Vietnam War effort to actually tangibly block the Vietnam War effort, whereas what we're seeing in the 128 corridor in this period is a lot of, like, flash and noise and protests and marches and whatever of many of these people literally working in this machine. And they would say, well, I'm against the Vietnam War for X, Y, and Z reasons, and I don't want these weapons that I'm designing to actually be used, or, you know, I want these jobs to be replaced with some other technical project that I can work on that's not this, but not actually doing anything to stop it, because that's something that would require solidarity actions and union type actions, as opposed to this individualist, like, putting on a button to say you're against the war.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, there are examples of some people who went further. One of the big ones is to stop the ABM missile, but that was also to not have it in having missile placements.
Right. I mean, they didn't want to get nuked. That's material self-interest. Yes.
Right. So I think that there's, I mean, you see it there. And I think there's like a few extreme examples, people like quit their jobs, you know, who, in protest, but for the most part, I think that it's where the kind of material still wanted to keep a job, just wanted to be doing something else. So in some ways it's like powerful that you have these people out saying, I don't want to do this. But at the same time, it's true that it was very, it's another place where you see the kind of limitations of that particular kind of activism. And sort of when you're privileging kind of suburban knowledge or tech workers and putting them at the forefront, like what are the limit possibilities of what is possible in terms of actual change. And I think that that's another thing. I think you're absolutely right that, like, a core, I mean, as I identify, I think this is, but a core component of kind of liberal politics is working within the system and not kind of trying to overthrow it. And that's kind of, that leads to kind of constraints in all types of ways.
Now, as the sort of main sort of thread that's throughout the book is that this McGovernite and Dukakisite tradition, despite being framed as, especially externally and by the Republicans, as some sort of extreme outlier and like far leftist throwback, whatever, that's not really the case, because despite the, you know, people would frame it as a contradiction of like, oh, Bill Clinton worked on the McGovern campaign in 1972, and then look what he did. And it's like, but is that really a contradiction? Because by the time you get to 92, the Clinton-Gore ticket and the Democratic Leadership Council, the New Democrats, the New South, all of that is simultaneously explicitly repudiating the image of people like McGovern or Mondale or Dukakis. And especially is repudiating the image that was being projected by people like George Bush and Lee Atwater about those candidates. But they're really embracing all of these agenda items while saying, oh, we have nothing to do with that. These guys were leftist extremists. But in fact, it's this suburban-oriented neoliberal politics. It's the emphasis on public-private partnerships. And that, unlike the image projected by someone like Lee Atwater, that's the real Dukakis governorship and campaign platform. And people like you mentioned, people like Larry Summers, those are people that Dukakis is originally, they're in his orbit and then go to the Clinton administration. So there's a kind of contradiction there, like on paper, that is actually resolved quite easily by looking at the actual history.
Yeah, I know. And that was one of the things that I really, I was surprised by from the book, I guess, but it is really there. And I think that and one of the things about Dukakis is that there's a reason, you know, there's the way that it's told, like, how is this person actually the presidential candidate for the Democrats in 1988, but he actually was up by a lot, and a lot of it had to do with this idea that he was a really, really competent governor who had engineered. I mean, this was his idea of this turnaround in the Massachusetts economy, but a lot of that had to do with this kind of a particular kind of faith in public-private partnership and market-based solutions. And I'll say this, my new book project is actually looking much more closely. It's looking at kind of public-private partnership, but also a lot of the Democratic Leadership Council. And I've talked to the members of the Democratic Leadership Council, and they, you know, who were quite critical of Dukakis, sort of in terms of his kind of, image, but did say that they believe in his policies. And then there's a real sort of direct line between what Dukakis did and was arguing for and Bill Clinton and going onward. So that does really sort of solidify this kind of shift that's happened within the Democratic Party around those types of policy choices.
Now, the sort of self-image projected by the Clinton administration in the 90s, helped by the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union, is, you know, this golden age of, like, this Pax Americana, unchallenged, peak of the world, etc. This has been subsequently replaced by, and I think re-examined even in that period, on the left at least, by this notion of managed decline of the American empire. And it seems like, again, a lot of the stuff that Dukakis is dealing with in a deindustrializing and then, so you could call it, post-industrial Massachusetts, is this idea of managing the decline. And that seems to be, I mean, that's literally basically almost, I would argue, the only thing that Biden is campaigning on this year. But, you know, he may disagree with that assessment. But the idea that, like, that's the Democratic Party message from, you know, that's the through line from McGovern to Dukakis to, you know, beyond, and certainly the current era, is not really promising to fix anything or bring the jobs back, but just to negotiate that decline and retrenchment in a more controlled descent than, you know, just letting everything collapse and mill towns collapse and whatever. For example, you talk about how one thing that got Dukakis the leadership support from labor unions for his presidential run was negotiating to require companies that received state funds to sort of voluntarily agree to notify workers at least 90 days ahead of factory closures to provide 90 days of health insurance coverage and career services afterward. I felt like this was the perfect symbol of the subsequent trajectory of both the party and the labor movement, because there's no promise that the jobs are coming back, but there is a promise that it's going to be a managed decline instead of a collapse. And it also, to go back to what Nate had alluded to earlier, it also contrasts with his first campaign for governor, where he was promising restored jobs and then became this budget hawk when things got tight fiscally. I mean, he also promises, you know, comes up with things that help feed into welfare reform and stuff of the 90s, like the employment training choices that we talked about earlier.
Yeah. And so, I think one of the things, it's not just about kind of, it's both about kind of managing particular kinds of decline. And this, it actually, the people who are really, this is like, you know, who is actually really, really influential in this type of thinking is Robert Reich. Which was this notion of kind of not trying to save, not trying to kind of save jobs in the U.S., but sort of embrace kind of globalization as the kind of solution to the U.S. economy's problems. I think he was really influential to Dukakis and then also to the Clinton and the New Democrats. But I would say that, I mean, part of that too is this and it has to do with a much longer set of questions around the Democratic Party's just not having a kind of trying to find a solution to the problem of growth in the U.S. I mean, the economy, like, what do you do? And it's both about managing the climate, but also their idea was that you're going to grow the pie. So that's a big idea, that you've kind of that growth is the solution. So it's growth over redistribution. And that is what the Democratic Party's kind of economic policy has really been since the 1970s. And those things fit in. And I think that, I think you're absolutely right. The other piece of this has to do with this kind of faith in worker retraining, which gets kind of reproduced every 2 to 4 years as the kind of solution to problems, and has not really been seen to work. But that was Dukakis' solution. That it was very much Clinton in the 90s was like, this kind of is this constant kind of worker retraining mantra, and I think that Hillary Clinton used it in 2016, and we're seeing it again now. So. Well, that's a very much a Democratic Party kind of this particular kind of ethos.
So let's talk about 2016, because your book came out before the 2016 election, and even before, you know, Bernie Sanders had gotten into the race for the primary side. I was wondering how you think that some of the election results that we've seen, you know, fit in with the trends that you describe and sort of extend or not what you talked about in the book as sort of the overall trend lines. For context for people, in the presidential primary in 2016, Hillary Clinton got over 60% of the vote in the primary against Bernie Sanders in all of the communities that were mentioned, but statewide, you know, it was a 49.9 to 48.5 split. It was very close, with actually quite minimal campaigning by the Bernie Sanders campaign. Then in the 2016 general election, we see at least 73% of the vote going to Clinton in all five of those communities. over Trump. There were some pretty significant swings compared to 2012 when Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney had been running. And we saw like places like Wellesley get that 13-point bump or swing. And that was something that was also seemed to be reflected in other places in the country that you allude to in the book, like Orange County, where maybe the tradition for a while had been to go in more of the fiscal conservative Republican direction, but seems to have settled at a similar convergent point where, you know, they're socially liberal-ish and kind of low tax and not really pushing for like universal programs the way that Bernie Sanders was pushing for.
Yeah. And I mean, I think one of the things, I guess, in the book that I was sort of gesturing to, and I would not have predicted, I mean, what has happened in the 5 years in American society and politics since then has been, you know, profound in many ways. I mean, it's not all of it is a kind of aberration. I mean, you can sort of, all of it was sort of, some of it could have been foretold. But I think especially the kind of the rise of the Sanders campaign and just a sense of the kind of many people's fundamental frustrations with the direction in which the Democratic Party was going. And I think particularly the kind of relationship around kind of its a role in kind of producing these types of sort of individualist programs and also kind of not addressing kind of fundamental structural economic and racial inequalities. So those sort of, I think you see playing out within the kind of the Sanders campaign and a kind of rejection of a particular kind of approach of the party. The issue with, you know, I think with this kind of red to blue movement that happened in 2018 within suburban communities and this kind of this notion, I think especially amongst the kind of establishment Democratic Party, that the solution lot, that the kind of party's kind of viability will be resting in the suburbs, can be sort of limited. I think there's been this sort of celebration of suburban communities as all of a sudden like becoming really sort of liberal and progressive. And I don't really see that happening. So I think I always gesture to in Orange County, you know, a lot of these communities that had been consistently Republican for a long time, or though were more purple, did vote for Democratic candidates, but at the same time, they also rejected a proposition that would have affected changing zoning policies to allow for more affordable housing. So I think you can see that kind of goes in the question of kind of around fiscal, a more kind of fiscally moderate approach that is also happening. So that those are the way that I see kind of the political landscape being played out a little bit. And I think the challenge right now is that, you know, this very much played itself out in the primary. And I think that is that this is not really, the Democrats have a very, very, if what we saw, I guess, over the last week of the convention is this idea of unity. It's a very unstable unity. And you have these kind of not just two, but many different sides of it that I think are going to be really, really difficult to hold together.
I think we also saw in the 2020 presidential primary in this 128 corridor that there is a bit of a fracture happening. I mean, you could maybe roll together the Biden and Bloomberg voters, but other than that, you can't really combine it was generally pretty consistent Biden, Warren, Sanders, Bloomberg for the most part. Statewide, though, it was Biden, Sanders, Warren, Bloomberg. And the 128 corridor, you've got the people that are just like really all in on the centrist establishment. You've got the people who are like, we're going to come up with these technocratic solutions that are liberal but not left. You've got the Sanders voters that are want an actual left solution to these things. It seems like there's a bit of a fracture going on there, but again, consistent, I think, with sort of the different tendencies that you describe in the book, where it's a little bit less homogenous than people might think.
Yeah, I think that's that. And I think that, you know, it'll be really interesting to kind of, and I think that's being played, that's another example of kind of where you can sort of see those communities as microcosms for these bigger kind of shifts that are happening within the party, and I guess within sort of American society more broadly.
Now, to that question of these divides within the party, a lot of it has been discussed in generational terms lately, but there's also probably a material component to that, I would argue almost certainly, because that's the tradition that I come from. But our friend Gary Alexander, who is a graduate student at the University of Kansas working under David Farber, he's also working on this issue, you know, the Atari Democrats, the DLC, that sort of topic area. But he was commenting to me about the household wealth accumulation, especially in the suburbs like we're talking about. Like, is this going to be a permanent feature where the millennials and to some extent Gen X have been kind of cut off from these material opportunities in a way that is going to fundamentally reshape their politics from what has been, you know, this pattern that you describe in the book for, you know, the past 50 plus years at this point in these suburbs?
Well, I think it's, I mean, I definitely think that to me, it's a more material issue than it is a generational one. So it's not, but I mean, I think that there's been profound kind of, one of the things that the difference of when I looked at in the 50s, 60s and 70s, that actually the suburbs are more affluent than they were then. So you see even more of this kind of resource hoarding mm-hmm. that I think has happened within within communities. But I think one of the things is that in that time too, the social safety net is even shredded further, and there's less of a sense of both kind of any kind of certainty. And I think one of the things, like post the kind of pandemic economic collapse, like when the dust settles, what that's going to look like is going to be really, really challenging. I mean, really challenging. So I see it much less so as a generational difference and more as a kind of a particular kind of class divide. And I think that millennials have bore the brunt of a lot of those kinds of changes. So that might be the place that you see it. But I do think amongst kind of Gen X voters, you still see a lot of people who are moving to the suburbs. And I think the other place, I mean, that the types of politics I look at, I mean, I located in these particular kinds of communities, but I think it's actually more of a kind of class political identity that's rooted in kind of liberal communities more broadly. And you can see it in urban areas too. And a lot of people who are affluent are now, you know, pre-pandemic were deciding to stay within cities. So I think places like Brooklyn, but a lot of, I mean, Boston has like the highest rate of gentrification of anywhere in the mm-hmm. country. And so I think in a lot of those kinds of neighborhoods, like Jamaica Plain or other neighborhood, like other kinds of places like that, you can see a similar type of kind of politics unfolding. Very much so. I mean, where I grew up in Cambridge, it's playing out. And I mean, I think that's kind of more where I see the split happening.
Yeah, I'm in Cambridge as well. And there's definitely elements of that. So.
And I saw the same thing happen in Jamaica Plain. I think one of the things that I notice in Newton happening right now, especially in the pandemic context, but more broadly, I mean, so we have, on the one hand, we have suddenly people who've literally never been on any sort of assistance finding themselves in such a dire situation that they're having to get free lunch prepared by the city. And that shows that there's definitely some people that are not totally secure financially here. But we also, as you say, it's getting, the financial concentration and the wealth concentration is getting starker because we see doctors and lawyers starting to get replaced by, you know, Fortune 500 CEOs and hedge fund guys and stuff like that at an increasing rate in a place like Newton. You know, sometimes we'll get people saying, oh, there's gentrification happening in Newton, which I think is a mistaken way of looking at it. But there is definitely a case to be made that upper middle class 1% people are getting replaced in some cases by, you know, 0.01% people or whatever. And that is going to, I think, in the at least short to medium term, continue certain trends of political consolidation here where you have social liberalism, but a very strident opposition to taxes and social welfare programs, and people who are, you know, finding themselves without a social safety net are not going to be getting any real relief on that front. And the push will continue to be, well, we'll just raise, you know, do some fundraisers or whatever with some of the richer people. But the question that I keep thinking as I'm, you know, walking around door to door in this community, when I'm running for office here, is like, that can't be sustainable. There's got to be, I mean, part of the trend that is, I think, pushing some of these suburban professional liberals into places like Jamaica Plain or Cambridge or Somerville or whatever is also a financial pressure, in the same way that they went to the suburbs because there was cheap land and cheap houses after World War II. We're now seeing that the gentrification is that they can actually afford to buy or rent in those formerly more urban places or semi-urban places within the city limits, and then they're leaving the suburbs because they can't compete against the home buying that's happening with like the hedge fund guys or the CEOs of these huge companies. That's that, and I can't see that that's sustainable though, because there's a smaller number of those super, super rich people. So how much longer can they really keep, you know, buying up everything in the suburbs and making that concentration of wealth even greater?
Yeah, I think, and it is like, that's sort of what end point. And I think it does seem like I don't live in Boston anymore, but from what I hear from my family and then also just sort of read, it's a real symbol of kind of these larger concentrations of wealth. And I think you do see it, the sort of, in so many ways, kind of suburban communities, as I look at in the book, you know, it represented this kind of the rise of the tech industry or knowledge workers. But now I think it is this kind of question around in Boston, the kind of reliance on hedge fund and as you mentioned, biotech wealth really affecting the environment that affects where people live. But I mean, one of the things that I'm struck by and, you know, and I've talked to journalists and reporters who asked me about kind of what with the rise of kind of Black Lives Matter protests happening in suburban communities is how much that's going to translate into kind of a willingness to expend money. And I think this goes to sort of another thing that I'm skeptical that that especially as there's a with the kind of economic fallout from the pandemic, that people are going to be willing to kind of get, it's going to lead to kind of a certain kind of generosity. I could be proven wrong on that, but I think that, you know, that are a lot of people in Newton going to say like, no, we have to kind of provide, we have to raise our taxes here, or we have to do a Prop 2.5 override because, you know, other people in Newton are in need. And I have in a long trend of kind of studying suburban history and suburban politics, I've just not seen that happen.
Well, for time reasons, I won't go into what just happened with the defund Newton police effort and the mayor. But I think, the economic conditions lead to a sense of like, well, we can't cut the police budget now because everything's going to deteriorate and our safety is going to be compromised.
That's exactly what I imagined happened. So I didn't even read it, but that was my prediction as to, and I think that's probably representative of a lot of other places.
To just connect back to the book here, because there's something that definitely speaks to this in the book, the $82,000 Metco gap in Newton that almost imperiled the program in Newton and was sort of restored at the 11th hour by Dukakis to give state emergency funds, $150,000, I think. But this was sort of during the period of mid-70s. There was a conservative surge onto the Newton City Council. And as we spoke about before recording, they blocked the Metro Pathways for Anger Students program that would have allowed them to study Charles River Ecology with Roxbury students. And this was sort of the conservative school committee, I guess, was concerned about the threat of metropolitan integration and were very staunchly opposed to that. So, you know, sort of how does this all play into what we could be seeing in the future?
Yeah, and I think the Metco example is a classic one of kind of this unwillingness to expend money, especially in moments of sort of economic crisis. And so I think that one thing the book actually more broadly tracks is kind of this question of what happens in the 1970s as there's this large recession, which now seems like a baby recession to what we're seeing today, but was hugely, it had a huge impact. And, you know, and I will say like people had, like it did cause tremendous kinds of hardship. People were losing their jobs and also that there was a lot of inflation, but what that leads on to is an unwillingness to spend money on things like Metco. And so there was a question of Metco's budget was shortened. Actually, it was actually a lot of communities wanted to expand their programs in response to the Boston busing crisis. But in Newton, it would have been spending like an extra dollar on having your taxes go up like a dollar, and people were just unwilling to spend that kind of money. And I think that to me is very sort of emblematic of suburban liberal politics. Mm-hmm. So I didn't say, I mean, one of the core arguments of the book is about this idea that people are the most liberal on the issues that are the furthest away from their kids' education, their tax rate, and especially their property values. And so things that are going to affect those kinds of, that's where you sort of see this, like the sort of the winnowing and winnowing. And I think that still very much is a factor at play.
Actually, there's a quote right here that I'm looking at from the William Herbert of the Massachusetts Teachers Association. And he's saying, in good times, it's easy to be a liberal, he declared. Prejudices are overcome to a certain extent, but when money is tight, people become frightened. And then there's some other quotes here. But yeah, I mean, that sort of encapsulates it, I feel like.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that, and I imagine my sense is that that's really going to sort of affect kind of local politics in suburban communities for the next period as well.
So the last thing I wanted to talk about briefly is about housing and zoning. I mean, that was something that we could spend hours more on, but we got to try to keep it focused. I just thought you might find this interesting. So there's a chapter in the book, you know, regarding affordable housing, regarding zoning battles, and it's a little bit different in each of these communities because there's definitely like a lot more density in Brookline than there is in Lincoln and so forth, and those are still relatively the same position as they were. But in Newton, at least, I felt like not much has changed since the 1970s struggle to present day. And Newton is, in fact, currently in the midst of a comprehensive zoning code redesign effort, which is the first time since the 1950s. We've also had some recent high-profile battles over mixed-use developments, although those are all private developments. There's no chance anymore of public developments, which goes out the window in the time period that you're talking about. There's also battles over Chapter 40B state requirements for affordable housing from 1969. You talk about that at some length in the book, the anti-snob zoning law. And we also, Newton had to settle in quarter, however you want to call it, with the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development recently after abandoning a small project, and I'm talking very small project, for formerly homeless people to live in my ward, which is something that I supported, obviously. But this is, you know, we're talking about, I think it was like maybe 6 units or something like that. It's a very small project. There's also a great deal of discussion today, as there was following the 1968 Kerner Report on race riots, about the suburbs' regional responsibility to build thousands of additional units of housing to ease the pressure on the Boston housing market with its economic and racial dimensions. And something that also emerges out of the city charter passed in the 69 reform, which I don't think you talked about in the book, is that there's now 4 neighborhood area councils and several neighborhood improvement associations just in Newton, and 4 of them overlap with my ward alone. And they often generate their own research and public surveys and fiscal calculations on supposedly what the impact is going to be of various residential projects so that they can either halt them or significantly modify them. I think that's something that is probably very familiar to you from looking at the reaction, I guess we'll call it, in the 1970s. And there's this routine expression of a concern that these changes to the zoning code or these new housing projects will fall within the already dense areas. This will be unfair, that it'd be the somewhat lower than typical areas in terms of income will get the brunt of this. The wealthy areas will remain untouched. That was an argument that you talked about in the 1970s in the book. And there was another chapter in the book on the rise of fair housing campaigns in this corridor. And I think this is something that I see us struggling with a lot, is the well-meaning white suburbanites who are not genuinely engaging the minority constituencies in Boston that they say they're working to help. And there's almost no grappling with the class dimensions at all. Like this, we're talking about very wealthy people who are trying to do the right thing, but just there's no analysis of class in that. And so there's a push, you know, where we need affordable housing, but then suddenly they're talking about attainable housing instead. And that gets back to this issue of like, are we helping low-income minority families, or are we trying to find minority families who can buy in at market rates and will fit in perfectly with the community because there's no friction there because they come from the same class, position, wealth, status, occupation, all of that. And we're also seeing still, which you talk about in the book, pressure to focus on senior housing and housing for existing local residents that's affordable, which those are important, but they also are in tension with that regional sort of problem or need to like think regionally on this. So I don't know if you had any thoughts about that, but I figured I would provide you with that update of what's going on here.
No, I mean, and I think my sense is similar things are happening in communities. Like I know Ann Arbor, where I went to graduate school, they're having very similar battles over kind of issues of trying to change zoning policies and people really fighting it. I think it's happening in Berkeley, California. I've heard of these various different things. But I think there's this common trend that's ongoing. I saw play out very much in the 1970s. I think it is this, there's a real question right now too about the way, and so I looked at this question in the 1970s of trying to So first, in the 60s, there was this idea of, like, let's let, like, fair housing means, like, anyone who wants to live in a community can, which has this idea of, like, people who have the same class standing, but recognizing that that wasn't actually addressing the problem, sort of built affordable housing. But I, in my sense, is that's really where, like, the rubber meets the road within suburban communities, and this kind of just consistent unwillingness to build meaningful affordable housing as a sort of serious problem. And I hope one thing that I have noticed is there's more discussion right now about zoning than there ever has, than I've seen in the kind of public discourse, so that maybe there'll be a discussion about the fact that when people want to think about the real source of residential segregation and residential inequality, that it really ties back to exclusionary zoning policies. But you both who deal much more with kind of local politics, how much there's a kind of willingness to kind of fundamentally change zoning codes in places like Newton and Cambridge too, to address these kinds of concerns.
Now, the book that we've been talking about today, Don't Blame Us, Suburban Liberalism and the Transformation of the Democratic Party, that came out in the beginning of 2015. And I know you've had a book or books since then, and you mentioned you've got other projects in the pipeline. So could you just sort of recap what you've done since the book that we've been focusing on today?
Sure. So I've written some articles that have kind of that connect to this as well. I wrote a piece called the Atari Democrats that was in Jacobin in 2016 that did deal with that election to some degree. I published and co-edited an academic book called Shaped by the State, looking at kind of political history from a more academic perspective. But my main project has been actually emerges from this book, which was a real interest in kind of the increase of the Democratic Party's use of market-based solutions. And so I'm looking at, it's the book that I'm working on now is called Doing Good, How Market-Based Thinking Took Over the Democratic Party. And it's looking especially at the efforts to use market-based solutions to address poverty and inequality with the Democratic Party. And this kind of how the idea of doing well by doing good became the party's kind of dominant ethos. It tracks on some of the issues. It's less kind of suburban focused, although there is a chapter, there's chapters on things like charter schools, things like microenterprise programs or microfinance, and then housing comes in around the Hope 6 and the effort to replace public housing with market-based solutions. So those are the types of programs that that book looks at. And I'm in the last year probably of working on it. So it's due to the editor in March. So I'm frantically trying to write and finish it, but that will be out probably in the spring of 2022.
All right. Well, Dr. Geismar, thank you so much for coming on Arsenal for Democracy to talk about this book and reflect on some of the things that have happened since it came out.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. It was a really interesting conversation. I learned a lot from both of you.
And Nate, thanks for being on the show as well.
Great to be here.